Welcome to our committee. I think this is the first time you've ever been here.
It is, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
You can go ahead and begin.
Okay, Madam Chair. Thank you. Senate file 92. The purpose of this is to address a problem in the healthcare area to have enough providers so that when children need to be admitted to the hospital, there's someone there, because if they're short on either the nurse or the other health care practitioner, then they won't allow the children in. And here with the best reasoning for this is my witness, Kim Schagel, and she's a constituent who brought the problem to me, and she can describe the motivation behind this bill for us.
Welcome.
Thank you. I want to start off by sharing a photo of my son. He is 12 years old and suffers from bipolar disorder and has suffered from mental illness related issues since the age of 2.5. He has been in the hospital 16 times. He should have been in the hospital much more than that. He's been turned away several times because there have not been enough beds for my son to be hospitalized. There are 4 hospitals in the state that will take children under the age of 12, and they are Abbott, Fairview Riverside, Mayo, and Duluth. And that equals to about 50 or less beds for kids under the age of 12. The day before we actually met to put this bill together, my son was actually denied a hospitalization at Abbott Northwestern, and on the way home, ran an attempted suicide by trying to jump out of the car on 694, and it was going 65 miles an hour. He should have been in the hospital. He almost died because there were not enough beds, and there was a period of time where he was so unstable that he had to wait 5 days for a bed just in the state of Minnesota. And that was about 4 years ago. They were sending kids all the way to Sioux Falls and out of state because there were no beds here.
Well, Senator Vanderveer and Ms. Schlegel, this bill isn't about beds, but we do have another bill on the floor of the Senate that's authored by Senator Pretner Solon that will create a child and adolescent psychiatric hospital in the northwestern suburbs of the Twin Cities. So
we have the beds. We don't have the staff.
Well, this hospital, of course, will be staffed. It wouldn't be able to be open if it wasn't staffed.
There's not enough mental health providers. Like, my son's psychiatrist had moved to Boston in November, and the psychiatrist that we went to transition over to, we had to wait 4 months for an appointment. And that's unacceptable for a child who's not doing well and is on heavy-duty medication.
Sure.
Madam Chair, if I could explain a little more. I think the problem wasn't that there aren't beds there when they go in. If they don't have these types of professionals, then the hospital won't admit them because this is the people that they need to have
there.
They're required to have there in order to take care of this type of patient.
The nurses, the therapists, the doctors. If there's not enough doctors, if there's not enough nurses, they won't accept the patients, and beds will go unstaffed.
Empty.
We understand that there is a shortage of child and adolescent mental health providers as well. Senator Vanderveer, we're hearing this bill because I think there is some stimulus money for loan forgiveness that might make doing something possible, whereas our budget situation doesn't really make it possible. But I think we might need to do just a little bit of work on your bill, because I believe we have already got loan forgiveness for child and adolescent psychiatrists in another section of the law that deals with physicians.
It's right up here.
And so, so I don't think we need pediatric psychiatry to be repeated.
It's in the, yeah, it's in for medical residents.
For medical residents, right. So in terms of a mid-level practitioner, maybe you could help us understand a little more what you're thinking about, and then maybe we can figure out how to get there.
A mid-level practitioner would be like a nurse practitioner with a specialization in pediatric psychiatry. And they would be able to staff clinics, which would help with the caseloads in clinics, as well as would help kids avoid the hospital as well.
Uh-huh.
Because they'd be able to be seen quicker.
Okay.
In an outpatient setting.
So I think if we mean psychiatric nurse practitioner who specializes in pediatric care, that we should probably say that instead of this wording is pretty.
Too.
This wording is pretty hard for. I think we need to be clearer, is what I'm saying. Maybe the staff can help work on that. Is there any other mid-level type of practitioner that you're thinking of?
Psychologists, social workers, any of those people that are able to provide therapy and help in crisis situations, such as married or licensed marriage and family therapists, licensed social workers, licensed psychologists. All those people can help provide these services for these children to help with the mental health crisis.
No, it doesn't work.
Okay, well, I don't think we're going to be able to do that broad a list, but Senator Coring.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Vanderveer, so is it, I'm trying to grasp what your intent is. So you're saying that if we have this loan forgiveness program, we have a shortage in the field that you're talking about, and if we have this loan forgiveness program, you think that that will increase the amount of people that will go into that particular field? I see heads shaking yes.
That's our intent, yes.
That's kind of where you're going, okay.
And the other thing that I'm just wondering about is whether we want to have this language in the section that deals with rural areas, because I think probably you're experiencing a shortage in an urban area.
We're experiencing a shortage everywhere.
Right, so we wouldn't want to just limit, or we wouldn't want to imply that we're limiting this to just rural areas. So I think we can help you get this in a little bit better shape, and then we can look at trying to target some or all of the stimulus money, which is one-time money, but still it would help get some more people into the pipeline.
Senator Berglund.
Yes. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I heard the discussion as I was coming in, sorry, about focusing the advanced practice, the language in the bill to the advanced practice for the pediatric psychiatric nurse. But the sentence on the first page, 1.14, says pediatric psychiatry or mental health. This isn't, I don't read that to be specific to focusing on pediatric care. Is this specific to pediatric mental health?
Well, there is a great need for all mental health, but especially pediatric.
Okay. Then as long as it's focused there. If it was broader, then I wouldn't narrow that language.
Okay. So I think folks are working on this a little bit right now, Senator Vanderveer, so maybe we could just set this aside for a few minutes and come back to it.
That would be great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Senator Marty.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the division. Senate File 666 is a follow-up to legislation that Senator Lori and Senator Torres Ray were working on last year. That dealt with young people aging out of foster care making sure they had some support, that they had a plan to deal with their housing and health care and so on. And this bill simply allows those young people who have aged out of foster care or who were on runaway status when they're age 16 or 17 would be able to come back and get help from the county to get the supports and services they need if their care, if they didn't have the planning done earlier, if they're not prepared for it. And the analogy I'd give to it is in, is one who's got kids, or at least a child in that age range right now, is a lot of young people at that age in a stable home bounce in and out of the home. They're out on their own, and you recognize the same thing. They're out on their own, but then they come back to deal with anything, whether it's housing or whatever. They come back, and so the most at-risk youth, we believe it's important that they have the opportunity to come back and just help them get their feet on the ground. Again, to the extent that under the new legislation from last year that I mentioned earlier, the fact that the counties and so on will be developing plans for young people, we hope there aren't that many who would fall into this category, but we do recognize that young people do come and go, and to make sure that they have the support they need. I have three brief witnesses to speak to this. First, Kristen Anderson Stembridge from LSS.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kirsten Anderson Stembridge. I serve as the Director of Advocacy for Lutheran Social Service in Minnesota, and I'm honored to join you to speak on behalf of the Youth Moving Forward Coalition and the Ready to Launch initiative today. This is an initiative that was crafted by youth, state, and county stakeholders, foster care providers, homeless youth service providers, and advocates to address the highest priority needs in our for our youth. This proposal represents an important step forward in our work together to assure the well-being of our most vulnerable youth and advance efforts that would prevent and end youth homelessness. Each year in Minnesota, approximately 600 youth who have been removed from their families and have not been given permanent families turn 18 and often find they are truly on their own. Foster youth are no more ready for independence at age 18 than their non-foster care peers. In fact, a comprehensive study in 2007 of youth aging out of care in Midwest states that was conducted by the Chapin Hall Center for Children at University of Chicago found that youth who age out of care experience far greater risks in life than their peers, including higher likelihood of homelessness, arrest and incarceration, early pregnancy, low educational achievement, and limited asset development. The same study includes preliminary findings and outcomes for youth who remain in care up to the age of 21. Initial findings indicate that simply accessing supports at age 19 are a strong indication that youth will enter college, gain far greater lifelong earning potential, and develop crucial life skills. In comparison to today's policies that ask vulnerable youth to establish full independence at age 18, we know that 95% of Americans are 25 or older before they are able to live self-sufficiently or on their own. Less than 10% of 18-year-olds live on their own. And in addition, recent estimates suggest that parents provide their young children with material assistance totaling approximately $38,000 between the ages of 18 and 34. Senate File 666 positions Minnesota to protect the investment we have already made in these youth and not abandon them just because they have turned 18, and assure basic supports extend to most of today's extended by most of today's parents, a place to return for help when things go wrong or supports simply go away. Seemingly basic expectations for youth who we have made the decision to parent when we remove them from their households of origin. Our youth in care, most specifically the 600 who age out and the others who have run from their placement, need us just as we need them. We need them to transition into healthy, productive adulthood, and they need us to continue that commitment to help ensure they can do just that.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Okay, you want to introduce your next witness, Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you this morning. My name is Denise Schmea. I am the director of the homeless youth programs at Face to Face in St. Paul. Face-to-Face provides street-based outreach, a drop-in resource center, and transitional living programs for homeless and near-homeless youth. In each program, we see youth who have become homeless or are precariously housed after running from care or aging out of foster care. I would like to share the stories of two resilient and amazing young people that I've had the opportunity to work with that illustrate the need for continued access to services until age 21. Christine was abused by her mother for many years, which led to her foster care placement. She described her time in foster care as lonely and scary. At the age of 16, she ran from her home, her foster home, hoping to go against the courts and stay with her mother. Christine found that this was far from a permanent living situation. She realized that many of the issues that led to her out-of-home placement still existed, so she ran again. Christine was unaware of the resources available to her, so she couch-hopped for the next 3 years. By the time she arrived at Safe Zone, she was 19, was 9 months pregnant, had dropped out of school, had no job, and lacked the skills needed to live independently. I ask you, how would her life have been different if she had access to services until 21? Darian met a Safe Zone outreach worker in downtown St. Paul. The outreach worker brought him to Safe Zone so he could take a shower and get a hot meal. However, these basic needs were only the beginning. During a counseling session with the Safe Zone mental health case manager, Darian described how he had been placed in the county's care after his mother was killed by his father. Darian was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and was feeling hopeless. He was abusing alcohol and felt by the age of 21 he would either be dead or in jail like his father. Since aging out of care without a housing plan, Darian had been sleeping in the entries of apartment buildings downtown. I ask you, how would Darian's view of his future have been different if he could have continued services until the age of 21? The answers to these questions are not simple. However, having access to services until the age of 21 could have benefited these youths and helped them avoid the painful realities of homelessness. All youth deserve a chance to live independently. The majority of the youth who aged out of care or run from care will be successful if they receive support and service resources until the age of 21. This is a critical developmental stage, and youth need a caring adult to help them learn the skills they need to be successful. I urge you to support Senate File 666 that allows youth access to services until the age of 21. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? If not, you want to introduce your last witness.
Hello, my name is Chenefai Fadness. I'm here to ask you to support Senate File 666 that will allow youth to remain in services until the age of 21.
You know, don't be nervous. You know, we work for all of you. So
okay.
You're our boss, so you don't need to worry about talking to us, okay?
Okay. I would like to share my story with you. I became involved in the foster care system when I was 14 years old because my mom had mental illnesses and my dad was abusing me. I stayed in one foster home that was overcrowded, a group home, and then finally another foster home. But she told me that I could have my own room. She made it seem so nice. I found out later that she was wrong. When I finally got a job, my foster mom made me sign my checks over to her. I couldn't spend the money that I earned. She often put us out on the weekends so her male friends could come over and spend the night. I got tired of the way I was being treated, so I left at the age of 17. For the next 2 years, I couch-topped. It was hard because I had to move every few months, but it was better than staying with friends than my foster home where I was being looked at as a paycheck. I eventually got into a transitional living program, and I lived there for 2 years. During the time, I had got a job as a peer outreach worker at Safe Zone. As an outreach worker, I see youth who run away or age out foster care and end up homeless. If they were able to receive services until the age of 21, they'll be able to be more stable, finish a higher education, and live on their own. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Senator Marty, thank you for bringing this bill, and thank you for your witnesses. This is an area that I think we should be doing a better job, but we also need to be aware that this is an area that the state doesn't pay for, that this is an area that the counties would be paying, and so we need to see how they feel about it. And so is there anyone here from the counties that wants to testify on the bill? Well,
they don't care.
Madam Chair, I'm not going to speak for them. I think they do care, but I think what we're hoping is that this is going to be a fairly minimal cost because two reasons, one of which is if the legislation that was carried last year has an impact, there will be a smaller number of kids in this situation. But, again, the alternative of the other costs they're going to be facing in the next couple of years with pregnancies and people getting involved in other trouble and so on, I just think we're going to be putting a heavier burden on the counties if we don't do this, and I realize that that doesn't, but maybe the counties have somebody here, but I know it's a concern.
I don't see anyone coming forward, so is there any discussion? This is a bill that would be able to go to the full finance committee. It does not need to stay here for an omnibus bill because it would not be involving state financing. Any discussion? Would Madam someone Chair. Like to make a motion? Or
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Marty, I'm sorry I came in late, but the foster care benefits, could you just give me a brief idea of what those include again?
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, what we're trying to do is make sure they have, just as our own kids may bump in and out of the home 18 to 21 years, a lot of these folks, they're not ready for, they don't have health care, they don't have housing, and to help
well,
make
this
sure.
This bill would not give them health care. We
them,
have other bills to
them.
Do that, and and we would have a fiscal impact to the state.
This
on
is
those
to help
bills.
Them get the plan, to help them get their feet, somebody to talk to help them get their feet back on the ground. And it follows up Senator Lori and Torres Ray had a bill last year to make sure that kids, before they leave foster care, get a plan to help address this. But a lot of kids don't.
I think it would be trying to get them hooked into more permanent, stable housing, helping them with planning for career, things like that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
So basically the relationships are already developed between the foster child and the person that they're dealing with. We just want to extend those to make it a little more seamless and make sure there's a backup.
Madam
situation.
Chair, this isn't so much, first of all, as the chair mentioned, this is not providing the services. This is just providing them the linkage so they can get access to it. And I don't know if it's fair to say, as far as you said, that there's a linkage established. These were young people in foster care. In the example we just heard, they ran away from foster care because the foster care was worse than elsewhere. But that doesn't mean they're ready to be on their own. And so the planning that we would have liked to have done before they leave foster care, we're saying if you need to step back, if all of a sudden you're overwhelmed, we want to help get you back into the system so that you can get placed at a safe place and get a job, get training, get whatever you need. So this is trying to link them up with the county to help connect them with what they need.
They would have had a caseworker
right.
at the county level, and this legislation would allow them to come back talk to that person and possibly receive services.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 666. Be recommended to pass and refer to
Finance.
Finance. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Senator Vanderveer, I think we're ready to finish your bill now. I think Ms. Kavanagh just has one small amendment.
Madam Chair, I believe on page 1, line 13, after the word or, you insert or to specialize. That would then take care of the issue. That would then allow this program to be available to a mid-level practitioner who agrees to practice in a designated rural area or to specialize in the area of pediatric psychiatry or mental health or to teach as stated here. And then for the nurses should work fine the way it is.
Okay, so Senator Lori will move adoption of that amendment for Senator Vanderveer.
Right.
Is there any discussion? Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, does that amendment take care of the problem that was identified, that we want to make this available across Minnesota, not just in areas? Okay. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor of that amendment say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. And then those in favor of laying this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill indicate by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you so much, members and Madam Chair.
Senator Torres Ray.
Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 1522. Know that these are tough economic times, but maybe many of you have heard the same stories and have learned about the significant challenges that food shelves are facing right now. And I happen to have some programs in my district and significant needs in the county that I represent, and my assumption is that you know about this issue quite well. And I decided to bring this to your attention because I believe that Minnesota, like other states, have an opportunity to perhaps put a plan in place to do significant outreach today take advantage of opportunities that may come before us with the stimulus money that is being now appropriated to expand benefits for food programs. One of the issues, Madam Chair and members of the committee, that became clear to me is that as we speak about expansion of programs and the federal government is moving in the direction of expanding access to these programs, what we know in Minnesota is that many people who are eligible and who could apply for those programs today are simply not enrolled. And so I am here today, Madam Chair and members of the committee, to ask for your support to increase funding for the food shelf programs and food stamp programs across the state of Minnesota. As you know, due to the economic downturn, more people than ever are turning to food shelf for assistance. From January to July of 2008, in Minnesota, food shelf usage was up 13%. And it was up 36% from the same period 5 years ago. The need for emergency food is dramatically increasing, and many food shelves are strained past their capacity. This bill will appropriate funding to continue these food shelf efforts. I have a couple of experts, Madam Chair, members of the committee, who deal with these issues every day, who will be able to speak with you about the numbers and the problems that we see today due to the economy. And this is particularly important because we have really two very vulnerable communities that are in need of these services, and they are young children who constitute 43% of the clients of this system, and a significant number of seniors who qualify for food stamps, but they are not applying, so they are coming to the food shelf programs that are located in their communities, churches, and localities. So with me, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I have Ms. Colleen Moriarty, who is the Executive Director of Hunger Solutions, and Ms. Kathy Mays, who is the Executive Director of Intercongregation Communities Association in Minnesota.
Welcome, Ms. Moriarty.
Thank you, Senator Berglund. In specific, I'm going to focus on senior outreach for food support, but if I could yield to Kathy Mays to talk about the current need at the food shelves, and as witnessed by her food shelf in Minnetonka, and as reported by many food shelves around the state of Minnesota. Kathy.
Okay, thank you. Good morning. And thank you for having us.
I do represent ICA Food Shelf in Minnetonka. We serve from Hopkins out to Shorewood, and thank you for having me back again. In January 08, we served 386 households food. In January 09, we jumped to 514. That's a 25% increase. We're currently serving one family every 15 minutes, so our business is up 25%. I attend a lot of regional meetings, and the story is the same, and we all have the same questions, and we're pushing each other, other executive directors, to talk about how we're doing business. So I wanted to share some of the questions we have. Should we be serving faster? Should we offer the ability for families to come back more often? How do we build the capacity within our own organizations to teach about the food program and food support, food stamps? Should we build greater capacity so we can have more food for these families to come back? And the questions continue to circle back to the increase in demands, our tight budgets, and quite frankly, the answer is always no. We can't do everything. We must find ways to help get more food to more people, but we need resources. How are we going to do it? We do need your support to help us with the food support and outreach education. We know that through the stimulus package, some of the strings have been untied, but we have to be able to educate all of our staffs across Minnesota because it's incredibly crucial to supplementing our clients' budgets. Currently, we only inquire at ICA if they use the system, but we don't know how to get them fully onto the system and to successful use. Another part of this bill talks about sustainable grants. We need that money to make certain that we can get the food in. Currently, grants only are allocated about 11% of our budget. Having a consistent pool of money specific to Minnesota food shelves would be a cost savings and come right out of our budget and give us some breathing room. You know, I wanted to share a quick story with you. Yesterday, I went down to the food room, and I wanted to talk to our food room manager, and he was chatting with a client. And I went up to talk. She was a young woman, about 30, 35, professional-looking, had bought a house. Their first month mortgage was a payment was about $1,200 on an arm. They had to foreclose after it got to $6,000 a month. They're now living in a small townhouse in Minnetonka, and they're using the food shelf to help support their monthly cause and their budget. I went back to my office and I drafted an email to our board and to our staff, and I said, during the next months, I'd like for the staff and the volunteers to offer our clients the ability to come as needed. Past practice has been once a month. Please extend our offering to our clients to come as often as you need. I'm certain this will be met with grateful hearts by many of our clients who are struggling to make their ends meet during this difficult season. I will actively track the usage and adjust as needed. I don't know if we can keep up with that. I have no idea how many people are going to come two and three times a month. But by supporting Senate House File 1522, I know we can get there.
Ms. Moriarty?
Thank you, Senator Berglund, members of the committee. I'm going to specifically address the need to work with seniors in our community to make sure that those seniors who are eligible for food support are actively enrolled in the program. Currently, we're at about 69% of the eligible enrollees in the food support program in the state of Minnesota. And as you heard in the previous testimony, there is additional money that's available through the stimulus program for already enrolled participants in the food support program and additional administrative support through the recovery package that will be going to the counties to be able to support that additional those additional needs. However, the one piece that is not in the stimulus package is the outreach to seniors and to vulnerable populations throughout the state to help them discover if they're eligible for the food support, how they get there, and how they get there with a form or CATH that's filled out with integrity that could be met by the county and could encourage their participation in the program. The asset limit, there have been several measures that have been addressed by this committee and this body and others to ease lift some of the restrictions on people who are participating in the food support program. And we thank you for those. We need to always be diligent about the fact that we're making this program as seamless as possible. The asset limit has been raised. The IRAs and tax-preferred retirement accounts are not counted as an asset, and seniors can request and should request a telephone interview if the county visiting the county office remains a burden. The maximum benefit has been raised. The average benefit in Minnesota is $67 a month, and family members can shop for seniors with their EBT card. Some of the measures that in the House that were heard last week in some of the House committees attempted to put up some additional barriers for people using food support. Suggestions like fingerprinting or photo IDing went down in the House committee last week after testimony from myself and members of the hunger community. As I said, only two out of the eligible 10 seniors are receiving food support, and currently there are 17,000 Minnesotans eligible for food support. Visiting a food shelf is a way that many people, in fact, as we've seen over 2 million visits last year, receive assistance. But there needs to be something more than a visit to a food shelf to build some kind of long-term answer to the hunger question. The public programs as they support hunger in our country represent about 22% of the overall vision of ending hunger. And philanthropic programs like food shelves and others, as good as they are and as well as they're functioning, are only about 5% of the answer. In fact, most of the people who are hungry in our community, 61% of the way that they meet their nutritional needs is through their employment or through other ways. So people are working hard to be able to get the food that they need to support themselves and their family. But that 22% that the government provides is very important. And we need to do a better job at every local outlet of enrolling people in the food support, of educating them of how they can get there, and of making that transition into a stable monthly income for as long as they need it, a satisfying one. The Children's Defense Fund developed the Bridge to Benefits program, which is a screening tool that we've encouraged our programs. We've tried to educate them on. The United Way has educated the hunger programs on how to use the Bridge to Benefits programs. But frankly, there just isn't the infrastructure in the food shelf community to be able to use that with people. There needs to be a second question. How can I help you today? And then how can we help you long term? Are you aware of the public programs that you may be eligible for? By implementing the Bridge to Benefits program in food shelves, the 300-plus food shelves around the state of Minnesota, that second question will be enabled to be answered. That's what we're asking you for here today. We want to be ready to take part in the recovery package. We want to make sure that every citizen in Minnesota who is eligible for a federal benefit is bringing those dollars back to the local community so that $1 turns into $9 that can stimulate the economy. Mark Sandy estimates from Moody's estimates that unemployment insurance and food support are the two best stimulus programs, and that's why they receive so much attention in the recovery program, and that's why we want to work with people at the local food shelves to make sure that those who are coming in and presenting with nutritional needs are also making every attempt, and we're making it easier for them to get to the county with that filled out form so that they can be enrolled in the food support program. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know if any of this food support money is available through our stimulus funds?
There's money for bulk purchasing of food for food shelves, and that's one of the reasons that we wanted to hear this bill today. We did have a one-time appropriation last year of $500,000. But I would say clearly, Senator Torres-Ray, we are not going to have an appropriation that could become part of the base. And so I think we're going to have to delete that language. And at this point, it's questionable whether we have any money in the stimulus package for food stamp outreach. There also is something in the homelessness section of the stimulus bill, but we're a little bit unclear yet exactly what the strings are that are tied to that money. But we do think you have a good bill here, and so we're looking for ways that we could help it become at least partly a reality through the stimulus money. So is there someone that would like to? Yes, Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Madam Chair, if there's no other discussion, I'd like to move the bill.
Well, this would have to be laid over for the omnibus bill, but we need to delete the appropriation shall become part of the base, because we aren't going to have any ongoing money to fund this with.
I'll move that.
Okay, so not only do we need to take that language out, we need to add language that would say that this would be a one-time appropriation. Okay. Ms. White can do that for us.
Madam Chair and members, on a line or page 1, line 8, delete everything after this and insert shall become a one-time appropriation and delete line 9. Do you want the same language on section 2, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Okay. I'll incorporate that into the amendment.
Okay. Is there any discussion of that amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. And then Senator Erickson Ropes moves that the bill be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, members.
Senator Hahn. Welcome to our committee. I don't think you've been here before.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, I haven't. And thank you, members. Good to see some of you. We've been having late nights in the other committee, but good to be here in the morning. But, and Madam Chair and members, I have a very short bill, and I have a couple of people here to testify. One is Dan Campo, who's a representative of the hearing instrument dispensers, and then Cammie Lawless to my immediate right, who is a actually one of the dispensers. And just to try to describe briefly, if I can, what the bill does, is, as you can see, it's very brief. It does not change any of the fees, but there is a fee that is collected that is used to regulate certification requirements for certified hearing aid dispensers. And the paragraph D at the bottom of the bill, lines 1.20 to 1.22, essentially says that the fees collected and charged can only be used to cover the costs associated with investigations for certified rather than uncertified. And the point being that if you are uncertified and you are not paying a fee, then the cost to regulate you should not be borne by those who are paying the fee. I think I've got that right, and so I'm going to turn it over to my testifiers to clarify in case I misstated that. But I think that is the intent.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
Identify yourself for the record.
My name is Cammie Lawless. I am a hearing instrument dispenser certified. I own a private practice hearing instrument dispensing clinic in Maplewood. I employ 4 other people, an audiologist, myself, and 2 receptionists. We're here today just to ask for support for Senate File 1755. What's been happening in the past, we're a very small group of people that are certified, and the investigations and enforcement, at this point, 50% of the current investigations opened are upon people that aren't even certified. So our fees, which keep going up, and there's another there's other issues where they're wanting to increase them to cover our debt that is being created by people that aren't even certified. Up to 80% of the expenses for enforcement and investigations are actually non-certified individuals. So our plea is that, whether it's the attorney generals or whoever, by adding this in, our fees should only have to cover what our group of people are doing, whether it's a complaint or what have you, instead of paying for people that might be somebody off the street selling hearing aids. I can't control those people, but yet we're paying the fees and bills to regulate, or I should say enforce and investigate those individuals.
Well, of course, it doesn't do your business any good if we allow people who are unregulated to be selling the same product that you sell.
Right, I agree. However, as far as for our group to be, we're certified, we pay the fees, and we regulate ourselves, but to have other people, there's another group, the audiologists, that are also licensed, and their fees cover their expenses, and they are... Also, many of them also dispense hearing aids, but they're not being assigned the fees or that expense for the non-certified individual or audiologist.
Okay.
So they're assigning that fee to our group directly.
Okay.
To the tune of 80% of that expense is actually uncertified people.
Questions, Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Hahn. I just wonder, I understand the fairness issue that your witnesses are raising, and it certainly seems like a valid point, but considering that if we don't have a way to make up the revenue, that we'll end up with a fiscal note, I would assume, and this wouldn't be revenue neutral, have you given any consideration to a way to spread those costs so that we can accomplish the same purpose with it being revenue neutral and treat everyone more fairly?
And Madam Chair and Senator Olson, we have not got any fiscal note on this. I don't know if there is any fiscal impact. The thought that I had in looking at this is that the department has a regulatory function, and I was assuming that this would just fall under the general regulatory duties of the department. And the point being that if you're charging a fee to be certified, that the point would be to try to have that fee apply to manage and regulate the people who are certified. And if there are other things going on that need to be regulated, that would come under the general duties of the department.
Senator Olson, we'll hear from the department in just a minute when we're done with the testimony, and you might want to direct your questions about whether this would leave a hole in their budget.
And, ma'am, there's also a fund set aside for some of these legal fees that are incurred, and these funds haven't been being used for that purpose. So that's also another possibility.
Okay. Any other questions? Seeing none, let's take the next witness then.
Madam Chair, Senators, my name is Dan Campbell. I represent the Minnesota Hearing Healthcare Providers. Basically, just for a little more informational and some of the numbers people were looking at them, the department did a study this past summer and fall. One of the things that they came up with was the vast majority of certified dispensers, 87% of them, do not have any open complaints at this time. That they have, for example, one uncertified person that has 9 open complaints against them. Another has 5 open complaints. So what we're talking about, sort of to re-summarize it, the whole thing, it's there's an enormous amount of cost going into looking at these uncertified dispensers and the number of open complaints. We agree that they shouldn't be out there doing what they're doing. The certified people are happy to be accountable for the costs associated with regulating them, but that there are there's a whole host of other costs. The fees have gone from $350 a year to this year they would jump to, I believe the number was $1,200 a year.
$1,250.
And we're concerned at the $1,250 rate that it'll have a negative impact on many of the businesses across Minnesota and put an additional strain in a tough economy.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? Okay, well then let's see if there's someone from the Department of Health that can come and help us with this a little bit.
Madam Chair, committee members, good morning. My name is Craig Akam. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Health. With me is Tom Hendelmeyer, our manager for the Office of Complementary Alternative Practices. So.
Welcome.
Thank you. And then we're just going to strike the university. To the point, the department is required to oversee hearing instrument dispensers. And to that end, we charge a fee for that activity. That includes the examination fee and the certification fee. We're also required to follow up on consumer complaints for both hearing instrument dispensers and audiologists. When those complaints come in, we don't know whether those people are certified or uncertified, but we're still required under the law to follow up on that complaint in the interest of consumer protection. The fees that we set reflect the actual cost of doing this activity, and we're required by law to set a fee that incorporates the amount of revenue needed to actually carry out the, you know, the intent of the statute over a four-year period. And otherwise, we don't charge a fee capriciously to do extra work that isn't required. And so while I understand the issues that have been brought up here today, the department needs a way to fund this activity. And in the governor's budget is a recommendation to actually increase the hearing instrument dispenser fees. We provide a report to the legislature outlining a number of different options regarding this problem. And our department and the governor both agreed to propose a fee increase to cover this work. And I don't know if Tom would add anything else to that, but
well, maybe you can tell us when you find someone who is being investigated who is not certified. Do you have a way to find them for, you know, practicing without having the proper certification? And do you ever collect revenues from that fining mechanism?
Madam Chair, Tom Hendelmeyer, Director of the Health Occupations Program. I think a little fuller picture is important here. When we receive a complaint from a consumer who has purchased a hearing instrument or may be about to purchase a hearing instrument, we immediately attempt to determine whether that person is certified or not. I understand the intent of the bill, but the effect would often be that we get a complaint against a person who's certified, and then that person becomes uncertified, or the person is a trainee, and they never fully qualify for becoming certified. Yet we have complaints against them. The numbers that are being used. To say that, you know, 80% of the investigation costs are against uncertified people is based on a snapshot that we took of the pending investigations that we had and the status of the individuals who were the subject of the complaints. And at that point in time, about 25% of them were not currently certified, but only a third of them. Only a third of the complaints concerned a person who had never been certified or in our system. So we're looking at individuals engaged in dispensing activity who are transitioning from learning how to engage in the practices involved and either falling out of the system or deliberately leaving the certification system.
Are there questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just say, you know, to Senator Hahn that I share the concern. We went through probably this isn't something you may know in as much detail since you're not on this committee, but there are a large number of significant fee increases that are in the governor's budget proposal that are going to have an impact on people who are in the business community. And as to all of those, it may be that while they may or may not, I guess I don't know if they exactly reflect the cost of doing business with regard to that specific activity. I'm concerned, though, and I don't think there's other language with regard to those other fees that says something like the fee must reflect, you know, exactly what the cost is of administering the service and must not be increased. You know, that type of language, I'm afraid, would provide the opportunity for something for class action litigation where it might be that departments would have to come back and defend exactly whether these fees are exactly related to those costs, which may fluctuate from time to time and so forth. And so putting that kind of precedent in the law might be an invitation to litigation.
Senator Hahn.
Madam Chair, and I appreciate that. I guess it kind of comes down to what is the purpose of the fee, perhaps. And it's been my understanding that the purpose of the fee was to provide certain regulatory oversight to people who've gone through the certification process. And I think that really is the heart of this. And I have been given some information that talked about that prior to 2005, the audiologists and non-audiologists were sort of combined, and the cost to regulate the dispensing of hearing devices was combined, and that there was sufficient funds to do that. And then in 2005, there was a split in the audiologist and non-audiologist dispensers, and that there was testimony at that point saying that there would not be disparate economic impact on these groups, which in fact has occurred. And so one of the reasons for the proposed bill is to go back and say, let's rectify this. There was some recognition that when we did that there would not be an impact on one group over the other with respect to regulating costs, and in fact there has been. And so that's really, I think, the intent here is to say if you've got a group that is being charged a fee to regulate the activities of that group and the money is being used to actually regulate activities of a group that isn't certified, there's something not right with that.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, though, that this isn't much different from all the other occupations that are licensed. And the purpose of those boards is to protect the public more than and to regulate that industry also or that profession. But I think, you know, there are physicians who are licensed, and I think the board's also there to protect the public from those who are posing as physicians and are not licensed by that board, or for psychologists and those who are not licensed as psychologists or for any of those professions. So it has a dual purpose of not only regulating that that profession, but also protecting the public.
Senator Olson?
And Madam Chair, I just wanted to quickly make the point that I think on this committee, most of us at least share your concern that fees should go for their intended purpose, and that's why when it comes to the healthcare access fee, that we are really trying to make sure, since that's called a fee and imposed as a fee, that it goes for its intended purpose, which is to pay for the things it was put in place to support.
We don't have a fiscal note on this bill, Senator Hahn, but we had a little extra time today, so I thought we'd hear from your witnesses, but without a fiscal note, we have to lay it aside. And so I think we're kind of at the point in our meeting where that's what we need to do next.
Well, Madam Chair and committee members, I thank you for the opportunity to bring this bill and appreciate your hearing this. And if we can't address that sufficiently at this point, maybe there's another time when we can.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.
Next, we'll take Senator Sharon. Senate File 366.
Additional amendment to get rid of the University of Minnesota costs. So that's study costs that they have been counting.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm presenting Senate File 366. It's a colorectal cancer screening proposal, a pilot project that establishes grants for a demonstration project to provide colorectal cancer screening to the uninsured and underinsured. The bill also provides for medical assistance coverage for the necessary treatment of diagnosed colorectal cancer. Section 1 of the bill extends medical assistance coverage to participants who would have been screened by the demonstration project and who need treatment for colorectal cancer. The coverage is limited to the services that are provided during the period that the individual receives treatment for colorectal cancer. Section 2 establishes the Colorectal Cancer Screening Prevention Act. It requires the Commissioner of Health to award grants to the Hennepin County Medical Center and Merit Care Bemidji for colorectal screening demonstration projects to provide screening to the uninsured and underinsured. Subdivision 2 requires the applicants to meet certain criteria. They have to be 50 years of age, at high risk or at high risk for colon cancer, be underinsured or uninsured, have coverage that does not fully cover the costs of colorectal screenings. They need to be eligible for medical assistance, general assistance, medical care, and Minnesota care programs, and have a gross family income below 250% of the federal poverty guidelines. Subdivision 3 requires the services provided under the demonstration project to include colorectal cancer screening and follow-up services for abnormal tests, diagnostic services to determine the extent of needed treatment. And Subdivision 4 requires the Commissioner of Health in consultation with the university to evaluate the demonstration project and make recommendations to the legislature. I do have a couple of amendments I'd like to make to the bill. This is its second hearing, so they would have to be not author's amendments, but amendments to the bill. They are oral amendments. Would you like me to do that at this time?
Yes, that would be fine.
I would like to make the following changes. On page 2, line 2.20 to 2.21, eliminate after the comma and the following language, in consultation with the University of Minnesota School of Public Health, comma.
You know, I'm having trouble finding where you are on page 2.
Page 2, oh. Line 2.20.
Okay.
And lines 2.21 that eliminates the clause in consultation with the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. Comma. And the commas.
Both commas go.
Both commas.
Both commas go. Okay. All right. Those in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That amendment is adopted.
And the second oral amendment would add Section 3. And in that Section 3, we would refer to as a federal waiver and request that the commissioner, the language would be, the Commissioner of Human Services shall seek a federal waiver in order to obtain federal funds for the services covered under 256B.057, Subdivision 11.
Okay. We've heard that amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Do you want to tell us about the federal waiver, the money that might be available?
I would defer to Mr. Godfrey if that would be okay to discuss how this might help the fiscal note of this bill.
Madam Chair, members, if you turn to the DHS section of the fiscal note, which I believe is page 9 of 9, last page. There's an assumption in the fiscal note which says that the Medicaid dollars that are paid out in this bill for 10 and 11 would not be matched by the federal government because the bill does not request a waiver be sought for the federal match or the federal portion of the program. And so in order to obtain the federal match, at least by the second fiscal year, inserting this language would allow the department to seek a waiver for that purpose. And if you look, it's the actual assumption is the second paragraph under assumptions on page 9.
Okay. And Senator Berglund, the other language that we eliminated would impact the fiscal note as well. It would eliminate under net expenditures the money that's dedicated to the University of Minnesota. So it would reduce the overall fiscal note in fiscal year 10 to $262,000 and in year 11 to $120,000.
Okay. And Senator Sharon, my understanding is that there is some other than medical assistance federal funding for states that begin colorectal screening programs. So
yes, the importance of this program in this budget year is that we are trying to position ourselves to secure a 3-to-1 federal match possibility from the Centers of Disease Control upon the enactment of their federal legislation. And we also have agreements with the Kohler Cancer Coalition, who has committed $15,000 to this project, and the American Cancer Society, that's committed an additional $25,000. So there's money there that we're trying to position ourselves to be able to access. And I have with me David Ahrens from the American Cancer Society that can speak to. We've chosen not to talk about the importance of colorectal screening today. We think that that's been presented in health policy, but more about what it is that we're trying to achieve from a fiscal perspective in this committee. So with your permission, I would introduce David Ahrens.
Thank you, Senator Berglund. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Ahrens, Director of Government Relations for the American Cancer Society. May I start with answering your question, Senator Berglund?
Yes, please.
There's sort of two tracks to secure federal money for colorectal cancer screening. Track one is what this bill is trying to do. Under federal legislation introduced in Congress, H.R. Introduced by Representative Kennedy and Granger, would create, under the CDC, a 3-to-1 stream of federal matching money, and only states that create existing colorectal cancer screening programs for uninsured persons and underinsured would receive special consideration for that federal matching money. That bill has not passed Congress yet. It's been introduced and is picking up co-sponsors. This bill would position us for that stream of funding if it becomes law. That's track one. Track two is the Center for Disease Control has issued a request for proposals to state health departments around the country, asking them to apply for existing federal colorectal cancer screening funding. My understanding is that our Department of Health is going to apply for that funding. It does not require a state match. It is simply applying for federal screening dollars. There is no guarantee that the state of Minnesota will win that award. And so this is sort of a two-track approach to trying to position ourselves for two different streams of federal colorectal cancer screening funding. The first would be very helpful because it would create 3-to-1 federal matching. The second is screening through the CDC. We don't know whether the state will win that award or not. We're very supportive of those efforts.
Is the money that's available through the CDC have to be matched also?
The money available through the CDC coming through their grant proposal that's currently pending would not have to be matched. It would simply be the state applies. If the state wins the award, it's competitive with other states, then it would get funding for screening. But, of course, it wouldn't be a continuing kind of thing. The funding would be limited over a certain number of years. That's why the Cancer Society is also encouraging the approach that this bill is taking, which is trying to position ourselves to be one of the 11 other states that have secured a spot for this special consideration offered by the Kennedy-Granger bill introduced, H.R. 1189, in the House of Representatives.
Well, I guess I would feel better about this if it were tied to receiving any of those monies rather than mandating the department to create a program when we don't know if we will get any federal money.
I agree with you, Senator, and we're under the Kennedy-Granger language that's in Congress. It says state-level programs that exist at the time that the bill becomes law would receive special consideration. So it puts sort of an onus on states to create their own tiny little programs to then get first in line for that federal matching funding. So that's why we presented this now, because we didn't want Minnesota to not be in line to receive federal matching funding if that bill became law. Other states have designed their colorectal cancer screening programs in various different ways of all different sizes, some very, very small, knowing that they're trying to create a placeholder for the potential of federal matching dollars.
Is creating medical assistance benefit for uninsured higher income people meet the criteria of having created a program?
That would be a part of it, yes, is under the federal bill would provide and treatment dollars. This would be unlike the current CDC's proposal, which is screening dollars only. The Kennedy-Granger approach is screening and treatment dollars that would marry up with a state-level program that had screening and treatment. Now, in the bill that we've proposed to this committee, out of 200 people, we only expect one or two would have colon cancer at the lowest localized stage cost, which would be about $20,000 per person of one to two people. So maybe $40,000 of impact on MA under Senator Sharon's bill. Because when people come into this project, they would be asymptomatic. They would not be showing signs of colorectal cancer. But the real benefit here is removing polyps and saving potential cancer costs, because the people in this program would likely be either uninsured or underinsured. So if they do have cancer, they're going to walk into Hennepin County Medical Center or Merit Care with cancer, and it'll be uncompensated care costs that will have to be treated at a much higher rate. And so by paying for $1,250 for a colonoscopy, it's removing polyps that could become cancerous. So that's the other attribute of this bill, is consistent with our cost containment goals, trying to spend money to remove something that we know is likely to cause higher treatment costs later.
Then there was also mention of some private dollars. Would those private dollars be made available to the Department of Health, or how would that work?
Sure. If this demonstration project became a reality, the Cancer Society would sit down with all the players, including the Department of Health, and say, we are ready to offer $25,000 of patient education services, because looking at the population served by this bill, it's people that not only need the screening, but they need education about the things that lead to colorectal cancer and follow-up education and services. These are some of the kinds of things the American Cancer Society can provide, and so we're willing to bring our resources to the table to help match this. The dollar amount of our services can be also used in putting up money for the federal match, because in-kind amounts are allowed in addition to cash amounts. And then the Colon Cancer Coalition, which runs the Get Your Rear in Gear Walk, the dinette's a fundraiser, is willing to put up $15,000 in cash to help support this effort, which will help with educational services. So we're trying to create a public-private partnership, not a new burden or a new government program, Senator.
Okay, well, if the Department of Health were to receive private monies, then there would have to be language in this bill to allow them to accept it and expend it. And if it's in-kind services, I think we would just need to have language that would indicate that they should be willing to partner with an organization willing to provide in-kind services. So I think we do need to do a little bit more work on the language of this bill before it's in good enough shape. And so maybe we can just set it aside for a few minutes and go on and see if we can get that language ready before we're done. And if not, we could come back to it at another meeting.
Thank you.
Senator Lynch has a question before we move on here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Ahrens, can you clarify, you mentioned that CDC has a grant process currently underway. And has the state of Minnesota applied for those grant dollars?
They're in the process of doing so, Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Mr. Ernst, so the answer is yes, the state of Minnesota has applied, or we are, I'm still not clear. Has the state of Minnesota applied?
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, I do not know if they have actually submitted their application. I do know that they're in the process of preparing their application, and the due date is coming up soon.
Maybe there's someone from the department that could come up to the table to answer that question.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Jane Korn, and I'm the medical director in the Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. Just to answer your question, yes, the department is preparing an application to the Centers for Disease Control under this current funding opportunity announcement. It would, the due date is April 10th. We have made a lot of progress on putting that application together, and we are working with many community partners' support to put that together, including the members of the Minnesota Cancer Alliance, the Cancer Society, many public nonprofit and volunteer organizations around the state who are supporting this. We will be able to apply for roughly $1 million, which can be used to pay for screening services but not treatment in this particular funding opportunity announcement.
And would it strengthen, do you believe, your ability to get the award if we had these private resources committed?
Well, this award will, this application is due soon. So I think if we can show that we have strong community support and there is some state commitment towards providing colorectal cancer screening, I think it will strengthen our applications. But just to be clear, this is a little bit separate from the Kennedy-Granger bill potential program that
right.
CDC.
We understand that.
Yes. But I think that to the extent that we can show that we have a state commitment in any degree to having a colon cancer screening program, I think that would be looked on very favorably in our application.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, I think we're ready with the language, so we don't need to set you aside yet.
Madam Chair, on page 2, after line 24, insert a subdivision 5 entitled Private Funding. And the language would read, the commissioner shall accept private funding for the colorectal screening demonstration project and may accept in-kind contributions.
So Senator Sharon moves that amendment. Any discussion? Senator Lori.
On that amendment, how certain are you that private funds are going to be available? I mean, sometimes we can make them contingent upon the receipt of private funds, and that can help the effort along. I know I feel a lot better when we say there's going to be matching funds rather than, you know, this, you could accept funds if you wanted to. If we could lock them in, sometimes that helps.
Senator Sharon?
I think the language allows the flexibility that might be important in this process, that allows the department to receive the money, whether it's cash or in-kind services, doesn't require them to do that.
Well, and we don't have a bill that's passed in Congress yet either, so.
We're talking about the private funds, too, though.
Right, but that the private funds would be available to help strengthen our case for getting money under the bill that hasn't passed Congress yet.
Right, but to the extent, I mean, it's fine if it was offered as food for thought, but to the extent that people come before our body and say, and we have private matching funds, we're willing to guarantee to match what the state is doing in this partnership, you know, I don't know, to me it means something, but.
What if the state doesn't do anything?
Well, any further discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed.
There's no state money.
The amendment is adopted.
Paying attention.
I voted for it.
I voted for it.
I did too.
Thank you. Thank you. We're all thinking.
I think we're all a little tired. It's only Wednesday, but we've been putting in a lot of long hours. So,
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
I do have a question, Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, about the federal waiver on this. And are the other 11 states seeking a federal waiver, or do they have their waiver in place? And okay. Is that difficult to receive a waiver on something like this?
Thank you. Senator Sharon.
Mr. Ahrens is going to answer.
Mr. Ahrens.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, some are seeking a federal waiver, some are not. Some have appropriated such a small amount of money that they're creating a pilot really as a placeholder to hope that this federal bill will come through. One of the reasons why seeking a federal waiver is important is to have the federal government pay for part of the Medicaid treatment costs if someone has cancer. And this would be very similar to what has happened with the SAGE breast cancer screening program here in Minnesota, where we do have a waiver from Department of HHS where the federal government can pay for a portion of the Medicaid expenses if a woman is found to have breast cancer and need treatment through the SAGE program. This is consistent with what we've done in other areas of cancer.
So, Senator Sharon, I think what we've done now is get your bill in a lot better shape, and what we're going to need to do is request another fiscal note based on the amendments that have been made. And so I think with that, we should just set it aside and leave consideration of it for the omnibus bill a possibility.
Thank you.
Why don't we take your next bill, which is Senate File 128.
Thank you. I want to thank Senator Coring and Senator Laurie also on this bill that we just laid on the table. It's for co-authoring that bill for colorectal screening. And this bill that I'm about to introduce, get my numbers right here. 128. This is I want to start out by acknowledging Senator Coring's longstanding work in trying to move this forward and recognizing the special needs of farmers who may be seen as asset rich but cash poor and have difficulty being able to access the healthcare system. And so, really, hats off to Senator Coring. And I appreciate the work that you've done there. His hat is off, apparently. Anyway, what this bill essentially does is ask the Department of Human Services to resubmit the federal approval for legislation that we passed under laws in 2007, which would eliminate the add-back depreciation for self-employed farmers in determining income eligibility for Minnesota CARE. Because of time, I can talk more about the context in which this piece of legislation is moving forward. But I think that that if you understand the essence of the request, that we're simply asking in this legislation for that waiver to be resubmitted, that we would stand for any questions that you might have about this bill. I have an expert with me, Tom Peterson, who will be able to answer your questions.
Well, I think we've had this in front of our committee over and over and over again, so I'm not sure if there are any questions.
Madam Chair, I just have a question to the chair. And I probably should know this, but I don't know it. When we ask for a waiver on this or any other waiver, does Congress have to approve that, or does the department have to approve it? How does that work? I guess just
Senator Coring, it's the department. Huh. This is an administrative waiver. And I think the reason that many of us feel we should ask over again is because other states have received the same waiver. And so the fact that we were denied last year, we sort of felt like it was one of the parting shots of the last administration. Did you want to make a comment as well?
Madam Chair, members, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Farmers Union.
I'd also add, too, that, you know, I've worked on this for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years, and I appreciate everybody's work, but we're also working now with the congressional delegation, because we've had, you know, Senator Klobuchar, Representative Walz, and Representative Peterson ask us about this issue and say, yeah, we've submitted it. So we're trying to coordinate, too, some help from them with the new administration, and we're optimistic about this next time.
So we're thinking a new administration and, you know, some of these crusty old guys that were just gotten into a mode of saying no. By the end, maybe we have been replaced with fresh new faces that would look at this and say, well, sure, other states have been given this. We should let Minnesota do this too. And if we get some additional support from our congressional delegation in working with those administrators, that probably would help too. Senator Sharon, in regard to the fiscal note, we are at a point in time where we're not sure what the future balance in the Minnesota Care Fund will be like. And so a number of the measures that we are promoting to save money in the general fund programs also are going to be saving money in the Minnesota Care Fund. So we need to look at that as we get closer to the end of getting all of our fiscal notes lined up. And but my thought is, you know, that we try and figure out whether we can have enough money to fund this. If not, we could still approve asking for the waiver, and after the waiver is received, then come back to do an appropriation. That has been done sometime also.
I think that makes a lot of sense, and I look forward to pursuing this further with you.
Any further discussion? Senator Laurie?
Madam Chair, I was just digging through the fiscal note, and I'd like to just take note that there's no enhanced federal FMAP in any of this, and so we're trying to figure out exactly why that is. It's understood that some of the population wouldn't be eligible for the enhanced FMAP that's going to be.
Well,
I
think it might be because they might need. I mean, by the time they get the waiver, the enhanced period might be over. I mean, the enhanced FMAP is just for a period of time.
Understood. But I'm just raising it as something that we should get behind a little bit more.
Sure.
I don't have the answer right now, but I think that...
Mr. Godfrey?
Madam Chair, Senator Laurie, members, I think also one of the issues here may be that this was actually a fiscal note that was completed pretty early in session on February 20th, and at that time the details of the stimulus package weren't known. So I would recommend to Senator Sharon we will get a new fiscal note on this to reevaluate it with the enhanced FMAP.
Okay. So with that, we'll just set this aside for a possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Great. Thank you very much.
Senator Berglund, welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senate File 695, I believe, your is up.
Right. Mr. Chairman and members of the division, this is a bill that simply requests that the Department of Human Services apply for federal funds. These would be funds that would be available through the stimulus bill, and they would be expenditures that are made on behalf of family stabilization service participants voluntarily engaged in food stamp employment and training activities where appropriate. This is money that is available, but we have to apply for it. And so the purpose of the bill was to make sure that we do apply for it. And of course, the fiscal note does show that if we apply for it, we would expect to receive some funding.
Senator Berglund, anybody that wants to speak on this bill?
I didn't ask anyone to come and testify. I sort of felt like the bill speaks for itself.
Okay. He's not coming here, is he? Okay. Are you going to just lay this over?
This would be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay. On that motion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion prevails. Is that it?
That completes the agenda today.
Nothing else. This committee is adjourned.